Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Anthropology. My name is Aliza Erdogan. Today, I'm joined by Lucas Ley, Head of Research Group at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Halle. We'll be talking about his book, Building on Borrowed Time, Rising Seas and Failing Infrastructure in Semarang, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2021. Thank you very much, Lucas, for joining us today.
Hi, Alize. Great to be here.
Wonderful. So at the New Books Network, we often like to start our episodes by getting to know our authors a little better. So can you tell us about your background as an anthropologist and how did this background lead you into this wonderful book?
Oh, sure. So currently I'm an environmental anthropologist, as you said, at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology in Halle. And I started in January at the MPI, and I'm working on, you know, broadly speaking, on socio-ecological change in coastal cities. And I did research in Jakarta during my master's and returned to Indonesia to, you know, do a PhD research project on flooding in Semarang, which is also a coastal city on Java. I got my PhD from University of Toronto, where I joined a team of graduate students, which was already working with Tanya Lee and Joshua Barker, who were sort of trying to create this hub for critical Indonesia or Indonesian research at the University of Toronto at this Department of Anthropology there. And yeah, it was an extreme privilege to work with my colleagues there. And I pitched, you know, after doing a master's or writing a master's thesis on illegal settlements or informalized settlements in Jakarta, I pitched to Tanya to work on climate change, which was quite vague, but work on climate change in Indonesia. And Joshua Barker was also supportive of it. And so, yeah, I embarked on this PhD research and returned to Indonesia. Yeah.
Well, we're very glad that this pitch led us into this wonderful book. And, you know, I'm very curious about your book's titular concept. So you developed this concept of building on borrowed time, and I think it really just beautifully illustrates how people relate to flooding and infrastructure through multiple iterations of the future. So I want to hear more from you on this term and what is at stake in thinking about infrastructure through borrowed time.
Yeah, thank you. So this term it's always fun to come up with titles, right? And I had to convince the press of keeping that title, which was also the title of the PhD thesis, which I then revised into this book, which took a couple of years. And so this term, I have to give credit to Tanya Lee to some extent, because it came up in these supervisory conversations that you have. You know, at best they're regular, and they were. I mean, it was really great to exchange with her and Joshua and my committee at the time and my colleagues. And so, you know, coming back from Semarang, where this research was conducted, I tried to articulate this impression of how people lived with tidal flooding, which was this regular occurrence in the former wetlands of this port city, and which forced these residents to constantly sort of reestablish the foundations of their life on these, you know, amongst crumbling infrastructures and at the edge of the sea. Even though they knew that this tidal flooding would always return, you know. So this is where I started thinking about what it means to live on borrowed time, because there is this horizon of the encroaching sea, and yet the coastal settlements of Semarang have, you know, endured in this you know, insecure situation and geography for a very long time. So let me return to Tanya, because when I said, you know, people are living on borrowed time, you know, as someone who didn't grow up speaking English, I guess I didn't know that this phrase was kind of too common. Like, I don't know. At the same time, it also conjured like a lot of different meanings that I wasn't aware of at the time. So we discussed it. And so we came up with this idea of building on borrowed time, because, you know, to respond to tidal flooding in Indonesia means to repair your house, build new roads, maintain the canals and the gutters, to allow for sort of water flow and prevent stagnation of tidal water in your private spaces. So this is how this sort of composite title came out, building on borrowed time. And it was quite productive in the end. And I think that thinking about it, I think your second question, thinking about infrastructure more broadly through this concept of borrowed time, helped me that infrastructure is this incomplete project, and it's constantly on the verge of breaking in Semarang. And yeah, that's kind of where it came in.
That's wonderful. And I love how, you know, you present your work as a collaborative project, right at its heart. Like, even when you talk about how you come up with the terms, I love how, you know, you're talking about the dialogues and conversations that lead to it. So it's very helpful to know. And I love how, you know, maybe you and Tanya and your research collaborators added building on borrowed time, because as infrastructure is incomplete, it's also constantly in the making and constantly a process of tinkering. So yeah, that's something I really enjoyed about the book. And, you know, I want to learn a bit more about your approach to Semarang. So throughout the book, you articulate Semarang as a place in becoming. And I'm curious about why we should understand Semarang and places like Semarang as places in becoming. And what does this emphasis on becoming tell us about the colonial entanglements that shape Indonesia?
Right. So this is the title of the first chapter, right? Becoming, where I try to do a historian's work and sort of combine representations of life in the coastal area of Semarang with these archival records that I found and which were scanned. But, you know, and what I just felt that this area, not just ecologically speaking, was always at unrest. You know, this area that the Dutch had sort of earmarked to house industries and be also a beacon of modernity by basically featuring the first railroad of the archipelago during colonial times. And in fact, very close to where I did my research and lived for about a year, you can still find the remnants of this first railway station of Indonesia. So this was, yeah, this area was just always undergoing rapid change. And yet at the same time, you know, the Dutch, the colonial administration decided to let it also deteriorate. So when they realized that the North couldn't be reliably and quickly developed using road infrastructure and railway infrastructure, simply because it's a very damp and very sort of, for the Dutch at least, disease-ridden environment, you know, full of mosquitoes and difficult to navigate because of the mangrove forest at the time. So they just kind of decided to let the native population at the time sort of take care of it. And so since these settlements popped up on the margins of Semarang, of this port city, very vibrant, you know, they had to make plans for the future, people who live there. They had to make do, and not just designers and city planners make these plans, but you know, normal people who have to, you know, make a living and get by. And they dealt with conditions and with ecologies that they didn't inherit. So were not of their own making. So these Dutch infrastructures that didn't fully work out and didn't fully drain and create this hygienic modern wetland. So they had to, on top of dealing with the volatile environment, they also had to deal with when these infrastructures stopped working properly. So this is where I think that against this notion of creating a fixed category, a fixed entity in the north of Semarang, it's actually a place in becoming, because people have to constantly respond to these insufficiencies of infrastructure and these insufficiencies of modern promise. So I guess in this chapter, I also try to show that when people respond and when people make plans, this doesn't mean like in modernist plans that things move from chaos into some kind of order, you know, and this is also drawing on Michael Taussig's idea. But actually, you know, what we have to also ethnographically account for is that things move from a kind of chaos into a new sort of chaos. And this process of becoming, I try to introduce in this chapter and then talk about it more in the following chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really fascinating way to forefront building on borrowed time, right? This earmarking, this constant process of becoming throughout the past into the present and the future. So that's fascinating. And, you know, throughout our conversation, you touched upon maintenance and repair a little bit. So I want to turn back to that and ask you kind of a selfish question. So I am really interested, and my work is rooted in questions of care. And I was really struck by your approach to caring in infrastructural maintenance. So what does care come to mean as residents and governments relate through infrastructure and as they build on borrowed time?
Yeah. So maybe I should just give an example of what people did, or, you know, where they took care of private belongings, things that that were dear to them, but also these really critical infrastructures that I mentioned earlier, which allow people to prevent flooding, or sometimes to at least keep it at a tolerable level, because flooding does occur all the time. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned this as explicitly in the book, or maybe this has changed. But yeah, this area is just sinking at this incredibly fast rate, between 5 to 15 centimeters per year. So sort of sinking and adjusting this critical infrastructure as well as your domestic space is just really, really important. And yeah, just some concrete examples of this care. I mean, I speak about Arif and Ariel in some of the chapters and throughout, I believe, because we just spent a lot of time, and I was privileged to hang out at their food stand regularly, almost becoming this sort of nighthawk. And they just make sure that the street is clean, you know, that it attracts people, that people can use it for transportation, that they stack wood on the riverbank, so that wood has to stay dry and cannot be subject to flooding. And, you know, at the same time, what was always really, you know, shocking to see, but also really impressive, is that their own house was below the street level. So it was far more susceptible to flooding, and regularly, in fact, was submerged. And there's a photo of you know, their submerged living room in the book, and they had to make sure to regularly sweep, you know, and drain this water, and it's just a very exhausting kind of labor of care. But I like this. I was really drawn to this, what Arif and Ariel do, because it's not just care for themselves, but for the neighborhood well-being as well. In the sense that Arif is neighborhood chief and just wants to attract more and more people into his pumping scheme, where he's able to, you know, through donations and his personal involvement, and his personal energy, really mobilize people to pump stagnant water and surplus water back into the drainage. And this is sort of his private scheme that has become a very, very, well, to some extent, it has become like an example for good and civil behavior. So the government has been paying attention to it, but also it just makes sure that neighborhoods do know about each other's flood risks, and that they can together find a more integrated solution, at least locally speaking, to preventing flooding. Yeah, so and yeah, living in the swamp, you know, living on this rapidly sinking soil, which is compacting year by year, and among this shoddy infrastructure that the state doesn't reinstate and that the Dutch left, you know, that just requires these practices of care. And as I said, it's kind of intersecting communal and individual care, infrastructural maintenance. Sometimes you care for family and relatives as well, by joining working parties, you know, but, what it showed to me is that all these practices of care are very exhausting. They just really tax people's energy. They are constantly necessary because of this potential of flooding and actual events of flooding.
Yeah, I think, you know, your work makes a very important contribution in the literatures that articulate care as constant labor and practice rather than just this, you know, ethical or moral stance that's abstract. And I love how you're bringing that in through thinking as something that generates care and makes it necessary. And, you know, besides thinking, you also articulate staying afloat or buoyancy as a chronic present in which marginalized communities act. And in fact, you know, your story about Arif and work of other community members, I think, really illustrate that. So I'm curious about what staying afloat tells us about marginalization as well, more broadly.
Yeah, staying afloat. I mean, there's obviously this relation to water and staying above water. But I think what this concept is owed to is an attitude or a commitment, involvement that I observed most strongly with my friend and informant Adin, who I also present in the book, who I remember this instance where he, on a particular day where he was particularly frustrated with the state of his neighborhood, because the improvement projects that had been carried out by the government were half-hearted and just not successful and left them in the dark, not very transparent. And so he said, you know, when I asked him, like, why are you doing this really important activist and organizational work to improve your place of, you know, where you grew up? Why do you do it? And he said, well, sometimes I just keep flowing. I'm just flowing. This is kind of this mengalir saja in Indonesian. And he said that right after, you know, one of these projects that he was an important and foundational part of, the Dutch Polder Project that I also write about in one chapter. After that kind of, you noticed, okay, this is not going anywhere. You know, this promise, both from the Dutch and Indonesian side, it's an empty promise in the end. And still, after realizing that this project might not lead to the expected outcomes, he kept sort of lobbying and kept networking, finding out, so where can we get grants? Where can we get funding to maybe empower these local youth to recycle plastic bags? Or I don't know, now he's thinking of composting and sort of using compost for organic gardening in the neighborhood. So yeah, this sometimes also optimist, you know, it might be considered a positive attitude or a disposition. This is very important to stay afloat. You know, stay in a position where you can still see what's happening, sort of access funding, stay connected. And this is what I call also buoyancy. And it's a very, people use and establish buoyancy to different degrees. You know, it's a very differentially distributed capacity. Because I also say that sometimes people cannot stay afloat, right? If you are a newcomer, or if you don't have the resources, or there's a tragic accident in the family, then this might lead, you know, that you cannot uphold this level of buoyancy, you know, which is another word, I think, for endurance. Yeah, but, you know, going back to this question of care, you know, sometimes, or very often, I realize that this buoyancy, like this making do, is romanticized. by the government. You know, it's really expected of people. It's almost this self-care and care for the neighborhood is sort of, yeah, it's expected from the government to show that you are able to kind of motivate yourself or be someone who's part of a legitimate development project. And so I was particularly impressed when I saw that, even when you embody this positive thinking and things go badly, you know, how do people manage, or I guess they have to, you know, and because next year, the soil will continue to sink, and they have literally no option. So this buoyancy also really is not voluntary.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's very important to articulate that buoyancy and even care often come from necessity, but also open up new capacities. And, you know, I love how you're taking us through your book through specific examples. And I want to ask you more about something you mentioned, the Polder Project. So, you know, throughout the chapter, this Polder Project really appears as one that's constituted by many delays and ruptures. And you show us that it gives rise to a political mode that you call pilot democracy. So I'm just wondering if you can elaborate on this concept through the Polder Project and ruptures and delays.
It's a catchy concept, isn't it? I'm not sure I elaborate sufficiently on it in the book, but maybe I write an article. I don't know. It's because, in fact, this Polder Project is still ongoing. And as you said, it's been around for a long, long time. In fact, it was I think the conceptualization phase was from 2002 to 2007, and then its implementation took even longer. And when I left Semarang to return to Toronto and try to make sense of what I saw, it was still unsure where this would go and if the plan would be realized, and in fact it wasn't, to the dismay of Adin and his collaborators. It was only piecemeal realized, and many components of this hydraulic system, most people probably don't know what a polder is, but it's this assemblage of hydraulic infrastructure, you know, hydraulic technology, pumps, riverbanks, dams, what the Dutch probably invented a long time ago, and now that they're trying to export it to many other countries that believe, you know, that they're probably struggling with the same ecological disaster as the Netherlands have for some time. But yeah, this perception of the shared perception of disaster, you know, that brought about this project, that really allowed the Dutch actors to successfully pitch it to the Indonesian central government at first, at workshops, and then after feasibility studies, Semarang was chosen to as a candidate, you know, where this pilot project. And what was pilot about it, and experimental in a sense, is the idea to form a democratic, inclusive authority, which, you know, after implementation would be responsible for maintenance and operation. So normally in Indonesia, it's a government affair. It's, you know, these polders are supposed to be run by experts and engineers and public servants. And so the Dutch pitched, and they had a lot of Indonesian supporters. They thought we need a new kind of governance. We need to create a sense of ownership, because, and this was an, you know, implicit criticism, because they basically said Indonesian infrastructure, the way it is built right now, will start crumbling and falling apart after a couple of years, because residents don't help maintaining it. So, I mean, yeah, that's a very, it's a very short, you know, short-sighted accusation, and very easy sort of explanation why things are the way that they are. But it somehow worked. Mm. You know, Indonesian side was very pleased with this idea. And yeah, so this pilot democracy that came about, you know, I just notice that according to this design, you could sort of switch it on and off, this democracy, this inclusive way of making decisions, consensual way of making decisions, and that really owes to the framing of crisis, and something I try to get at in the book, that, you know, when we think of the catastrophe, the impending catastrophe of climate change, you know, it allows to create and dream up these new forms of governance. But in the case of Semarang, these were not rooted in some kind of inclusive institutional process. So this pilot democracy, it did embody promise, but this promise from the get-go hinged on foreign support and on a shared framing of what was going on a planetary level. So in the sense, you know, this pilot democracy is an effect of the way in which we frame climate change as this problem that concerns us all to the same degree. And kind of envisioning nature going awry, producing these future catastrophes. But what I show in Semarang is that this democracy concept sort of prevents these structural changes that are necessary to involve and get more participation from the local communities. And that would actually place power, you know, place decision power in the hands of climate change victims that live on the front lines of this, mm-hmm. of this event.
Wow. Yeah, that's really fascinating. And it's indeed a catchy term. Yeah, I can see it catching on. But yeah, so I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about your methodology, but also like your methodology follows so seamlessly from your theoretical framework, which I found to be a testament to your fieldwork job. So that really stood out to me. And you use thinking in as a methodological metaphor in the book when you expand on your fieldwork. So could you tell us more about what this metaphor does for you and how it informs your methodology?
Thinking, I mean, it's obviously a phenomenon or something that I daily observed on my daily walks along the river. You could tell from signs on bridges or the water level that this area was in fact sinking. You know, this was not owed to sea level rise only, which is only responsible for a fraction of the sinking process. So I guess from you know, in ethnography or in anthropology, we get trained throughout our graduate studies that immersion is something needed to establish a situated kind of knowledge, and that this also involves long-term or at least mid-term emotional, psychological, and intersubjective labor. And for me, living in these low-lying areas of Samarang, and to some extent being involved in these processes of care that I mentioned, that meant, you know, I'm actually, you know, literally sinking with people. Like I'm sinking just as, you know, they on a daily basis sink with the floodplain and the human artifacts that were built on it. And I think this is kind of my attempt of dwelling in this disaster, and which is something that Kim Fortune, for example, urges us to do, and Anne Ellison. But, you know, saying this, and this is also really important to me, I'm not saying, you know, I was sort of experiencing disaster as people did, the people that I spoke to daily, but I just developing this kind of sense of going down below, that was important. And just when I was doing this field work, I was also reading about deep diving a little bit as a hobby. And there's this book by James Nestor called Deep, where he speaks about sinking as not this negative process that usually causes anxiety and sort of bodily trauma for us, but it's also this kind of effortless process, this movement that can be pleasurable and a wanted thing. And so that sort of sinking in over time and sort of trusting that this is the right thing to do, I think that really informed my sort of daily, my psyche, like in my methodological approach to, and in this process of sinking, sort of learning what's at stake sort of for people of enduring this catastrophe, yeah, of climate change that is unfolding through these very opaque infrastructures.
That's such a wonderful way to put it. And I wonder if, you know, you also found yourself trying to stay afloat in some ways.
I mean, no, I, you know, I'm not... I guess when you become a trusted interlocutor, and you sort of are expected also at some point to perform this labor, like of staying afloat and in a sense by being a white scholar and being from the outside and being a more privileged person, I was certainly becoming sort of a node in this network that allowed buoyancy. So in the sense that people would approach me and ask me what the government thinks about this project. Do you have any ideas about this? Can you point us to sources for funding, for instance. And so, yes, to some extent, you, I guess I was more sort of ethically obligated to help some people stay afloat rather than actually doing and experiencing that myself. I wouldn't claim that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, that points out to a very, you know, important issue where, you know, it shows that you're not just extracting this data to write this book, but coming up with ways in some capacity and as necessary to contribute to buoyancy, I guess. And, you know, I was also struck to the very rich photoethnography in the book, and I found it very useful to elicit the links between architecture, homemaking, and temporality. So could you speak a bit more to what the visual does for your thinking on these issues?
I was very happy when University of Minnesota Press allowed me to include these photos. I'm not a professional or not even close photographer, but it was an honor to be allowed to, you know, portray this particular neighborhood street. It's so the photos you see in the book of houses which are basically located or basically adjacent to one another, and you see from the photos that they're very different styles, very different architecture. You can to some extent see what socioeconomic standing the person has. So that was really important for me to like show that this is not this homogenous kampong, you know, but you have actually this really important diversity, you know, style, stylistically speaking, culturally speaking, and economically speaking. And at the same time, these houses, they showed so beautifully that, you know, they were alive and they had to constantly morph and change to sync with, you know, sync with a Y, with the changing socio-ecological conditions and the political ecology of water infrastructure. And so these houses were traces of time. You know, they had this really intimate relationship with the time spans of these water systems. And sometimes when I try to do this in these very short captions, and I wish I had more time or more space to write about the architecture and the dwellers' sort of situations, but they speak of past lives, and in a sense you see that some houses already contain architecturally the seeds for the future. Like they are built way too high, you know, people actually have to hike up, you know, these stairs, which is completely unnecessary, but in that sense they are harbingers of the future, because they, you know, the dwellers, the residents, they envision there's the trend of the encroaching sea to continue. And there's one picture of a newly built or freshly built home where, yeah, people have to go up these stairs before they can enter their house. And one of my informants, he joked that you can read from this house, you can see that this person doesn't trust the government, because it would not come through with any of the infrastructural renewals that they had promised. And so this shows, you know, that people have these intricate and very, very personal, isolated also strategies to sync time-wise. Yeah.
Yeah, I found it very useful for, you know, the built environment to come alive. So I'm also thankful for the press for allowing the photos to be there. Well, yeah. Speaking of the future, my last question is, what is next for you? What are some new projects, questions, even courses that you're working on right now?
Yeah, the future. I'm super privileged. After a phase of insecurity and job wise and not sure, what the future of my anthropological work would be, I managed to get a grant from the German Scientific Foundation, which allows me to do more research on urbanized coasts at the Max Planck Institute for Social Anthropology. And after studying water infrastructure, this time I will focus on minerals. I will assemble a team of researchers. So anyone interested in sand listening to this, and if you're trained in anthropological methods, then get in touch, because this is new research project meditation, collective meditation on sand at the Max Planck Institute in Halle. And I think I will just continue doing this sort of research that is trying to understand spatial and social marginalization by looking at political ecologies and how cities are shaped by ecological processes. And no course is planned so far because this wonderful grant allows me to focus on research. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, we'll be really looking forward to this new project. And again, let's remind our listeners, if you're interested in these topics, please get in touch with Lucas. All right. Well, thanks so much, Lucas, for joining us and for your insights.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Alize.
Of course, it's my pleasure. I am Alize Arıcan. This discussion of building on borrowed time, rising seas and failing infrastructure in Semarang, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.